long you wanted to spend on the computer. They gave you like an hour of time. That's all you'd get, he said, laughing at the memory. But someone figured out that if you put in time equals and then a letter, like T equals K, they wouldn't charge you. It was a bug in the software. You could put in T equals K and sit there forever. Just look at the stream of opportunities that came Bill Joy's way. Because he happened to go to a far-sighted school like the University of Michigan, he was able to practice on a time-sharing system instead of punch cards. Because the Michigan system happened to have a bug in it, he could program all he wanted. Because the university was willing to spend the money to keep the computer center open 24 hours, he could stay up all night. And because he was able to put in so many hours, by the time he happened to be presented with the opportunity to rewrite Unix, he was up to the task. Bill Joy was brilliant. He wanted to learn. That was a big part of it. But before he could become an expert, someone had to give him the opportunity to learn how to be an expert. At Michigan, I was probably programming 8 or 10 hours a day, he went on. By the time I was at Berkeley, I was doing it day and night. I had a terminal at home. I'd stay up until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning watching old movies and programming. Sometimes I'd fall asleep at the keyboard. He mimed his head falling onto the keyboard. And you know how the key repeats until the end and it starts to go beep, beep, beep? After that happens 3 times, you have to go to bed. I was still relatively incompetent even when I got to Berkeley. I was proficient by my 2nd year there. That's when I wrote programs that are still in use today, 30 years later. He paused for a moment to do the math in his head, which, for someone like Bill Joy, doesn't take very long. Michigan in 1971. Programming in earnest by sophomore year. Add in the summers and the days and nights in his 1st year at Berkeley. It's 5 years, he said, finally. I didn't start the day I started at Michigan, so maybe 10,000 hours? That's about right. Is the 10,000-hour rule a general rule of success? If we scratch below the surface of every great achiever, do we always find the equivalent of the Michigan Computer Center or the hockey all-star team, some sort of special opportunity for practice? Let's test the idea with 2 examples. And for the sake of simplicity, let's make them as familiar as possible. The Beatles, one of the most famous rock bands ever, and Bill Gates, one of the world's richest men. The Beatles, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr, came to the United States in February of 1964, starting the so-called British invasion of the American music scene and putting out a string of hit records that transformed the face of popular music. The first interesting thing about the Beatles, for our purposes, is how long they had already been together by the time they reached the United States. Lennon and McCartney first started playing together in 1957, 7 years prior to landing in America. Incidentally, the time that elapsed between their founding and their arguably greatest artistic achievements, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and the Beatles' White Album, is 10 years. And if you look even more closely at those long years of preparation, you'll find an experience that, in the context of hockey players and Bill Joy and world-class violinists, sounds awfully familiar. In 1960, while they were still a struggling high school rock band, the Beatles were invited to play in Hamburg, Germany. Hamburg in those days did not have rock and roll music clubs. It had strip clubs, says Philip Norman, who wrote the Beatles' biography, Shout. There was one particular club owner called Bruno, who was originally a fairground showman. He had the idea of bringing in rock groups to play in various clubs. They had this formula. It was a huge nonstop show, hour after hour, with a lot of people lurching in and the other lot lurching out. And the bands would play all the time to catch the passing traffic. In an American red light district, they would call it nonstop striptease. Many of the bands that played in Hamburg were from Liverpool, Norman went on. It was an accident. Bruno went to London to look for bands, but he happened to meet an entrepreneur from Liverpool in Soho who was down in London by pure chance, and he arranged to send some bands over. That's how the connection was established. And eventually, the Beatles made a connection not just with Bruno, but with other club owners as well. They kept going back because they got a lot of alcohol and a lot of sex. And what was so special about Hamburg? It wasn't that it paid well. It didn't. Or that the acoustics were fantastic. They weren't. Or that the audiences were savvy and appreciative. They were anything but. it was the sheer amount of time the band was forced to play. Here is John Lennon in an interview after the Beatles disbanded, talking about the band's performances at a Hamburg strip club called the Indra. "We got better and got more confidence. We couldn't help it with all the experience playing all night long. It was handy them being foreign. We'd try even harder, put our heart and soul into it to get ourselves over. In Liverpool, we'd only ever done one-hour sessions, and we just used to do our best numbers, the same ones at every one. In Hamburg, we had to play for 8 hours, so we really had to find a new way of playing." 8 hours? Here is Pete Best, the Beatles' drummer at the time. "Once the news got out about that we were making a show, the club started packing them in. We played 7 nights a week. At first, we played almost nonstop until 12:30 in the morning when it closed, but as we got better, the crowd stayed till 2 most mornings. 7 days a week? The Beatles ended up traveling to Hamburg 5 times between 1960 and the end of 1962. On the first trip, they played 106 nights, 5 or more hours a night. On their second trip, they played 92 times. On their third trip, they played 48 times for a total of 172 hours on stage. The last 2 Hamburg gigs in November and December of 1962 involved another 90 hours of performing. All told, they performed for 270 nights in just over a year and a half. By the time they had their first burst of success in 1964, in fact, they had performed live an estimated 1,200 times. Do you know how extraordinary that is? Most bands today don't perform 1,200 times in their entire careers. The Hamburg Crucible is one of the things that set the Beatles apart. "They were no good on stage when they first went there, and they were very good when they came back," Norman went on. "They learned not only stamina, they had to learn an enormous amount of numbers, cover versions of everything that you can think of. Not just rock and roll, a bit of jazz, too. They weren't disciplined on stage before that, but when they came back, they sounded like no one else. It was the making of them." Let's now turn to the history of Bill Gates. His story is almost as well known as the Beatles. Brilliant young math whiz discovers computer programming, drops out of Harvard, starts a little computer company with his friends called Microsoft. Through sheer brilliance and ambition and guts, builds it into the giant of the software world. That's the broad outline. Now, let's dig a little bit deeper. Gates's father was a wealthy lawyer in Seattle, and his mother was the daughter of a well-to-do banker. As a child, Bill was precocious and easily bored by his studies. So his parents took him out of public school and, at the beginning of 7th grade, sent him to Lakeside, a private school that catered to Seattle's elite families. Midway through Gates's 2nd year at Lakeside, the school started a computer club. The mother's club at school did a rummage sale every year, and there was always the question of what the money would go to, Gates remembers. Some went to the summer program where inner-city kids would come up to the campus. Some of it would go for teachers. That year, they put $3,000 into a computer terminal down in this funny little room that we subsequently took control of. It was kind of an amazing thing. It was an amazing thing, of course, because this was 1968. Most colleges didn't have computer clubs in the 1960s. Even more remarkable was the kind of computer Lakeside bought. The school didn't have its students learn programming by the laborious computer card system like everyone else was doing in the 1960s. Instead, Lakeside installed what was called an ASR33 teletype, which was a time-sharing terminal with a direct link to a mainframe computer in downtown Seattle. "The whole idea of timesharing only got started in 1965, Gates continued. Someone was pretty forward-looking. Bill Joy got an extraordinary early opportunity to learn programming on a timeshare system as a freshman in college in 1971. Bill Gates got to do real-time programming as an 8th grader in 1968. From that moment forward, Gates lived in the computer room. He and a number of others began to teach themselves how to use this strange new device. Buying time on the mainframe computer the ASR was hooked up to, of course, was expensive, even for a wealthy institution like Lakeside, and it wasn't long before the $3,000 put up by the Mother's Club ran out. Parents raised more money. Students spent it. Then a group of programmers at the University of Washington formed an outfit called Computer Center Corporation, or C-Cubed, which leased computer time to local companies. As luck would have it, one of the founders of the firm, Monique Rona, had a son at Lakeside, a class ahead of Gates. Would the Lakeside Computer Club, Rona wondered, like to test out the company's software programs on the weekends in exchange for free programming time? Absolutely. After school, Gates took the bus to the C-Cubed offices and programmed long into the evening. C-Cubed eventually went bankrupt, so Gates and his friends began hanging around the computer center at the University of Washington. Before long, they latched on to another outfit called ISI, which agreed to let them have free computer time in exchange for working on a piece of software that could be used to automate company payrolls. In one seven-month period in 1971, Gates and his cohorts ran up 1,575 hours of computer time on the ISI mainframe, which averages out to 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. "It was my obsession," Gates says of his early high school years. "I skipped athletics. I went up there at night. We were programming on weekends. It would be a rare week that we wouldn't get 20 or 30 hours in. There was a period where Paul Allen and I got in trouble for stealing a bunch of passwords and crashing the system. We got kicked out. I didn't get to use the computer the whole summer. This is when I was 15 and 16. Then I found out Paul had found a computer that was free at the University of Washington. They had these machines in the medical center and the physics department. They were on a 24-hour schedule, but with this big slack period, so that between 3 and 6 in the morning, they never scheduled anything." Gates laughed. "I'd leave at night after my bedtime. I could walk up to the University of Washington from my house, or I'd take the bus. That's why I'm always so generous to the University of Washington, because they let me steal so much computer time." Years later, Gates's mother said, "We always wondered why it was so hard for him to get up in the morning." One of the founders of ISI, Bud Pembroke, then got a call from the technology company TRW, which had just signed a contract to set up a computer system at the huge Bonneville Power Station in southern Washington state. TRW desperately needed programmers familiar with the particular software the power station used. In these early days of the computer revolution, programmers with that kind of specialized experience were hard to find. But Pembroke knew exactly who to call. Those high school kids from Lakeside who had been running up thousands of hours of computer time on the ISI mainframe. Gates was now in his senior year, and somehow he managed to convince his teachers to let him decamp for Bonneville under the guise of an independent study project. There he spent the spring writing code under the direction of a man named John Norton, who Gates says taught him as much about programming as almost anyone else he'd ever met. Those 5 years, from eighth grade to the end of high school, were Bill Gates's Homburg, and by any measure, he was presented with an even more extraordinary series of opportunities than Bill Joy. Opportunity number one was that Gates got sent to Lakeside. How many high schools in the world had access to a time-sharing terminal in 1968? Opportunity number two was that the mothers of Lakeside had enough money to pay for the school's computer fees. Number three was that when that money ran out, one of the parents happened to work at C-Cubed, which happened to need someone to check its code on the weekends, and which also happened not to care if weekends turned into weeknights. Number four was that Gates just happened to find out about ISI, and ISI just happened to need someone to work on its payroll software. And number five was that Gates happened to live within walking distance of the University of Washington, and number six was that the university happened to have free computer time between 3 and 6 in the morning. And number seven was that TRW happened to call Bud Pembroke, and number eight was that the best programmers Pembroke knew for that particular problem happened to be two high school kids. And number nine was that Lakeside was willing to let those kids spend their spring term miles away writing code. And what did virtually all those opportunities have in common? They gave Bill Gates extra time to practice. By the time Gates dropped out of Harvard after his sophomore year to try his hand at his own software company, he'd been programming nonstop for 7 consecutive years. He was way past 10,000 hours. How many teenagers in the world had the kind of experience Gates had? "If they were 50 in the world, I'd be stunned," he says. "There was C-Cubed and the payroll stuff we did, then TRW. All those things came together. I had a better exposure to software development at a young age than I think anyone did in that period of time, and all because of an incredibly lucky series of events. If we put the stories of hockey players and the Beatles and Bill Joy and Bill Gates together, I think we get a more complete picture of the path to success. Joy and Gates and the Beatles are all undeniably talented. Lennon and McCartney had a musical gift of the sort that comes along once in a generation. And Bill Joy, let's not forget, had a mind so quick that he was able to make up a complicated algorithm on the fly that left his professors in awe. That much is obvious. But what truly distinguishes their histories is not their extraordinary talent, but their extraordinary opportunities. The Beatles, for the most random of reasons, got invited to go to Hamburg. Without Hamburg, the Beatles might well have taken a very different path. "I was very lucky," Bill Gates said at the very beginning of our interview. That doesn't mean he isn't brilliant or an extraordinary entrepreneur. It just means that he understands what incredible good fortune it was to be at Lakeside in 1968. All the outliers we've looked at so far were the beneficiaries of some kind of unusual opportunity. Lucky breaks don't seem like the exception with software billionaires and rock bands and star athletes. They seem like the rule. Let me give you one final example of the hidden opportunities that outliers benefit from. Suppose we do another version of the calendar analysis we did in the last chapter with hockey players. And this time, we'll look at a list of the 75 richest people in human history. It includes queens and kings and pharaohs from centuries past, as well as contemporary billionaires like Warren Buffett and Carlos Slim. Do you know what's interesting about this list? Of the 75 names, an astonishing 14 are Americans born within 9 years of one another in the mid-19th century. Think about that for a moment. Historians start with Cleopatra and the pharaohs and comb through every year in human history ever since, looking in every corner of the world for evidence of extraordinary wealth. And almost 20% of the names they end up with come from a single generation in a single country. Here is a list of those Americans and their birth dates. The first American is the richest man of all time, John D. Rockefeller, born in 1839. The second richest man of all time is also on the list, Andrew Carnegie, born in 1835. The 28th richest man of all time, Frederick Weyerhaeuser, born in 1834. Number 33 of all time, Jay Gould, born in 1836. The 34th richest, Marshall Field, born in 1834. The 35th richest, George Baker, born in 1840. Number 36, Hetty Green, 1834. Number 44, James G. Fair, born in 1831. Then Henry Rogers, born in 1840, J.P. Morgan, born in 1837, Oliver Payne, born in 1839, George Pullman, born in 1831, Peter Widener, born in 1834, and Philip Armour, born in 1832. What's going on here? The answer becomes obvious if you think about it. In the 1860s and 1870s, the American economy went through perhaps the greatest transformation in its history. This was when the railroads were built and when Wall Street emerged. It was when industrial manufacturing started in earnest. It was when all the rules by which the traditional economy had functioned were broken and remade. What that list says is that it really matters how old you were when that transformation happened. If you were born in the late 1840s, you missed it. You were too young to take advantage of that moment. If you were born in the 1820s, you were too old. Your mindset was shaped by the pre-Civil War paradigm. But there was a particular narrow 9-year window that was just perfect for seeing the potential that the future held. All of the 14 men and women on that list had vision and talent, but they were also given an extraordinary opportunity. In the same way that hockey and soccer players born in January, February, and March were given an extraordinary opportunity. So let's do the same kind of analysis for people like Bill Joy and Bill Gates. If you talk to veterans of Silicon Valley, they'll tell you that the most important date in the history of the personal computer revolution was January 1975. That was when the magazine Popular Electronics ran a cover story on an extraordinary machine called the Altair 8800. The Altair cost $397. It was a do-it-yourself contraption that you could assemble at home. The headline on the story read, "Project Breakthrough, World's First Minicomputer Kit to Rival Commercial Models." To the readers of popular electronics, in those days the Bible of the fledgling software and computer world, that headline was a revelation. Computers up to that point had been the massive expensive mainframes of the sort sitting in the white expanse of the Michigan Computing Center. For years, every hacker and electronics whiz had dreamt of the day when a computer would come along that was small and inexpensive enough for an ordinary person to use and own. That day had finally arrived. If January 1975 was the dawn of the computer age then, who would be in the best position to take advantage of it? The same principles apply here that applied to the era of John Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie. If you're too old in 1975, then you'd already have a job at IBM out of college, and once people started at IBM, they had a real hard time making the transition to the new world, says Nathan Mervold, who was a top executive at Microsoft for many years. You had this multi-billion-dollar company making mainframes, and if you were part of that, you'd think, why screw around with these little pathetic computers? That was the computer industry to those people, and it had nothing to do with this new revolution. They were blinded by that being the only vision of computing. They made a nice living. It's just that there was no opportunity to become a zillionaire and make an impact on the world. If you were more than a few years out of college in 1975, then, you belonged to the old paradigm. You had just bought a house, you're married, a baby's on the way, you're in no position to give up a good job and pension for some pie-in-the-sky $397 computer kit. So let's rule out all those born before, say, 1952. At the same time, though, you don't want to be too young. You really want to get in on the ground floor right in 1975, and you can't do that if you're still in high school. So let's also rule out anyone born after, say, 1958. The perfect age to be in 1975, in other words, is old enough to see the coming revolution, but not so old to have missed it. Ideally, you'd want to be 20 or 21, which is to say born in 1954 or 1955. There's an easy way to test this theory. When was Bill Gates born? October 28th, 1955. That's the perfect birth date. Gates is the hockey player born on January 1st. Gates's best friend at Lakeside was Paul Allen. He also hung out in the computer room with Gates and shared those long evenings at ISI and C-Cubed. Allen went on to found Microsoft with Bill Gates. Paul Allen, January 21st, 1953. The third richest man at Microsoft is the one who's been running the company on a day-to-day basis since 2000, one of the most respected executives in the software world, Steve Ballmer. Steve Ballmer, March 24th, 1956. Let's not forget a man every bit as famous as Gates, Steve Jobs, the co-founder of Apple Computer. He wasn't from a rich family like Gates, and he didn't go to Michigan like Joy, but it doesn't take much investigation of his upbringing to realize that he had his Homburg too. He grew up in Mountain View, California, just south of San Francisco, which is the absolute epicenter of Silicon Valley. His neighborhood was filled with engineers from Hewlett-Packard, then as now one of the most important electronics firms in the world. As a teenager, he prowled the flea markets of Mountain View, where electronics hobbyists and tinkerers sold spare parts. Jobs came of age, breathing the air of the very business he would later dominate. Here is a paragraph from Accidental Millionaire, one of the many Jobs biographies, that gives you a sense of how extraordinary his childhood experiences were. Jobs attended evening talks by Hewlett-Packard scientists. The talks were about the latest advances in electronics, and Jobs, exercising a style that was a trademark of his personality, collared Hewlett-Packard engineers and drew additional information from them. Once he even called Bill Hewlett, one of the company's founders, to request parts. Jobs not only received the parts he asked for, he managed to wrangle a summer job. Jobs worked on an assembly line to build computers and was so fascinated that he tried to design his own. Wait, Bill Hewlett gave him spare parts? That's on a par with Bill Gates getting unlimited access to a timeshare terminal at age 13. It's as if you were interested in fashion and your neighbor growing up happened to be Giorgio Armani. And when was Jobs born? February 24th, 1955. Another of the pioneers of the software revolution was Eric Schmidt. He ran Novell, one of Silicon Valley's most important software firms, and in 2001, he became the chief executive officer at Google. Eric Schmidt, April 27th, 1955. I don't mean to suggest, of course, that every software tycoon in Silicon Valley was born in 1955. Some weren't, just as not every business titan in the United States was born in the mid-1830s. But there are very clearly patterns here, and what's striking is how little we seem to want to acknowledge them. We pretend that success is exclusively a matter of individual merit, but there's nothing in any of the histories we've looked at so far to suggest things are that simple. These are stories instead about people who were given a special opportunity to work really hard and seized it, and who happened to come of age at a time when that extraordinary effort was rewarded by the rest of society. Their success was not just of their own making. It was a product of the world in which they grew up. By the way, let's not forget Bill Joy. Had he been just a little bit older and had to face the drudgery of programming with computer cards, he says he would have studied science. Bill Joy, the computer legend, would have been Bill Joy, the biologist. And had he come along a few years later, the little window that gave him the chance to write the supporting code for the internet would have closed. Bill Joy, the computer legend, might well have been Bill Joy, the biologist again. By the way, Bill Joy's birth date? November 8th, 1954. Joy would go on, after his stint at Berkeley, to become one of four founders of Sun Microsystems, one of the oldest and most important of Silicon Valley's software companies. And if you still think that accidents of time and place and birth don't matter all that much, here are the birthdays of the three other founders of Sun Microsystems. Scott McNeely, November 13th, 1954. Vinod Khosla, January 28th, 1955. Andy Bechtolsheim, September 30th, 1955. Chapter 3, The Trouble with Geniuses, Part 1. Knowledge of a boy's IQ is of little help if you're faced with a form full of clever boys. In the fifth episode of the 2008 season, the American television quiz show 1 vs. 100 had as its special guest a man named Christopher Langan. 1 vs. 100 is one of the many television shows that sprang up in the wake of the phenomenal success of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. It features a permanent gallery of 100 ordinary people who serve as what's called the mob. Each week, they match wits with a special invited guest. At stake is $1 million. The guest has to be smart enough to answer more questions correctly than his or her 100 adversaries. And by that standard, few have ever seemed as superbly qualified as Christopher Langan. Tonight, the mob takes on their fiercest competition yet, the voiceover began. Meet Chris Langan, who many call the smartest man in America. The camera did a slow pan of a stocky, muscular man in his 50s. The average person has an IQ of 100, the voiceover continued. Einstein, 150. Chris has an IQ of 195. He's currently wrapping his big brain around a theory of the universe, but will his king-sized cranium be enough to take down the mob for $1 million? Find out right now on 1 vs. 100. Out strode Langan onto the stage amid wild applause. You don't think you need to have a high intellect to do well on 1 vs. 100, do you? The show's host, Bob Saget, asked him. Saget looked at Langan oddly, as if he were some kind of laboratory specimen. Actually, I think it could be a hindrance, Langan replied. He had a deep, certain voice. To have a high IQ, you tend to specialize, think deep thoughts. You avoid trivia. But now that I see these people, he glanced at the mob, the amusement in his eyes betraying just how ridiculous he found the proceedings. I think I'll do okay. Over the past decade, Chris Langan has achieved a strange kind of fame. He has become the public face of genius in American life, a celebrity outlier. He gets invited on news shows and profiled in magazines, and he's been the subject of a documentary by the filmmaker Errol Morris, all because of a brain that appears to defy description. The television news show 2020 once hired a neuropsychologist to give Langan an IQ test, and Langan's score was literally off the charts, too high to be accurately measured. Another time, Langan took an IQ test specially designed for people too smart for ordinary IQ tests. He got all the questions right except for one. He was speaking at 6 months. When he was 3, he would listen to the radio on Sundays as the announcer read the funny papers aloud and follow along on his own until he had taught himself to read. At 5, he began questioning his grandfather about the existence of God and remembers being disappointed in the answers he got. In school, Langan could walk into a language test where he had not studied at all, and if they were 2 or 3 minutes before the instructor arrived, he could skim through the textbook and ace the test. In his early teenage years, while working as a farmhand, he started to read widely in theoretical physics. At 16, he made his way through Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead's famously abstruse masterpiece Principia Mathematica. He got a perfect score on his SAT, even though he fell asleep at one point during the test. He did math for an hour, his brother Mark says of Langan's summer routine in high school. Then he did French for an hour. Then he studied Russian. Then he would read philosophy. He did that religiously every day. Another of his brothers, Jeff, says, you know, when Christopher was 14 or 15, he would draw things just as a joke, and it would be like a photograph. When he was 15, he could match Jimi Hendrix lick for lick on the guitar, boom, boom, boom. Half the time, Christopher didn't attend school at all. He would just show up for tests and there was nothing they could do about it. To us, it was hilarious. He could brief a semester's worth of textbooks in 2 days and take care of whatever he had to take care of and then get back to whatever he was doing in the first place. On a set of 1 versus 100, Langan was poised and confident. His voice was deep. His eyes were small and fiercely bright. He did not circle about topics, searching for the right phrase, or double back to restate a previous sentence. For that matter, he did not say or ah or use any form of conversational mitigation. His sentences came marching out, one after another, polished and crisp like soldiers on a parade ground. Every question Saget threw at him, he tossed aside as if it were a triviality. When his winnings reached 250,000, he appeared to make a mental calculation that the risks of losing everything were at that point greater than the potential benefits of staying in. Abruptly, he stopped. "I'll take the cash," he said. He shook Saget's hand firmly and was finished, exiting on top, as we like to think geniuses invariably do. Just after the First World War, Lewis Terman, a young professor of psychology at Stanford University, met a remarkable boy named Henry Cowell. Cowell was raised in poverty and chaos. Because he did not get along with other children, he had been unschooled since the age of 7. He worked as a janitor at a one-room schoolhouse not far from the Stanford campus, and throughout the day, Cowell would sneak away from his work and play the school piano. And the music he made was beautiful. Terman's specialty was intelligence testing, the standard IQ test that millions of people around the world would take over the following 50 years, the Stanford Binet, was his creation. So he decided to test Cowell's IQ. The boy must be intelligent, he reasoned, and sure enough, he was. He had an IQ of above 140, which is genius level. Terman was fascinated. How many other diamonds in the rough were there, he wondered. He began to look for others. He found a girl who knew the alphabet at 19 months and another who was reading Dickens and Shakespeare by the time she was 4. He found a young man who had been kicked out of law school because his professors did not believe that it was possible for a human being to precisely reproduce long passages of legal opinions from memory. In 1921, Terman decided to make the study of the gifted his life work. Armed with a large grant from the Commonwealth Foundation, he put together a team of field workers and sent them out into California's elementary schools. Teachers were asked to nominate the brightest students in their class. Those students were given an intelligence test. The students who scored in the top 10% were then given a second IQ test. And those who scored above 130 on that test were given a third IQ test, and from that set of results, Terman selected the best and the brightest. By the time Terman was finished, he had sorted through the records of some 250,000 elementary and high school students and identified 1,470 children whose IQs averaged over 140 and ranged as high as 200. That group of young geniuses came to be known as the Termites, and they were the subjects of what would become one of the most famous psychological studies in history. For the rest of his life, Terman watched over his charges like a mother hen. They were tracked and tested, measured and analyzed, their educational attainments noted, marriages followed, illnesses tabulated, psychological health charted, and every promotion and job change dutifully recorded. Terman wrote his recruits letters of recommendations for jobs and graduate school applications. He doled out a constant stream of advice and counsel, all the time recording his findings in thick red volumes entitled Genetic Studies of Genius. There is nothing about an individual as important as his IQ, except possibly his morals, Terman once said. And it was to those with a very high IQ, he believed, that we must look for a production of leaders who advance science, art, government, education, and social welfare generally. As his subjects grew older, Terman issued updates on their progress, chronicling their extraordinary achievements. "It is almost impossible," Terman wrote giddily when his charges were in high school, "to read a newspaper account of any sort of competition or activity in which California boys and girls participate without finding among the winners the names of one or more members of our gifted group." He took writing samples from some of his most artistically minded subjects and had literary critics compare them to the early writings of famous authors. They could find no difference. "All the signs pointed," he said, "to a group with the potential for heroic stature." Terman believed that his Termites were destined to be the future elite of the United States. Today, many of Terman's ideas remain central to the way we think about success. Schools have programs for the gifted. Elite universities require that students take an intelligence test, like, say, the American Scholastic Aptitude Test, for admission. High-tech companies like Google or Microsoft carefully measure the cognitive abilities of prospective employees out of the same belief. They are convinced that those at the very top of the IQ scale have the greatest potential. At Microsoft, famously, job applicants are asked a battery of questions designed to test their smarts, including the classic, "Why are manhole covers round?" If you don't know the answer to that question, you're not smart enough to work at Microsoft. If I had magical powers and offered to raise your IQ by 30 points, you'd say yes, right? You'd assume that would help you get further ahead in the world. And when we hear about someone like Chris Langan, our instinctive response is the same as Terman's instinctive response when he met Henry Cowell almost a century ago. We feel awe. Geniuses are the ultimate outliers. Surely there is nothing that can hold someone like that back. But is that true? So far in Outliers, we've seen that extraordinary achievement is less about talent than it is about opportunity. In this chapter, I want to try and dig deeper into why that's the case by looking at the outlier in its purest and most distilled form, the genius. For years, we've taken our cues from people like Terman when it comes to understanding the significance of high intelligence. But as we shall see, Terman made an error. He was wrong about his Termites. And had he happened on the young Chris Langan, working his way through Principia Mathematica at the age of 16, he would have been wrong about him for the same reason. Terman didn't understand what a real outlier was, and that's a mistake we continue to make to this day. One of the most widely used intelligence tests is something called Raven's Progressive Matrices. It requires no language skills or specific body of acquired knowledge. It's a measure of abstract reasoning skills. A typical Raven's test consists of 48 items, each one harder than the one before it, and your IQ is calculated by how many items you get right. If I gave you the hardest question on the Raven's, I'm guessing you wouldn't get it correct. Nor would I. Chris Langan almost certainly could, however. When we say that people like Langan are really brilliant, what we mean is that they have the kind of mind that can figure out puzzles like that last Hardest Ravens question. Over the years, an enormous amount of research has been done trying to figure out how a person's performance on an IQ test like the Ravens translates to real-life success. People at the bottom of the scale, with IQs below 70, are considered mentally disabled. A score of 100 is average. You probably need to be just above that mark to be able to handle college. To get into and succeed in a reasonably competitive graduate program, meanwhile, you probably need an IQ of at least 115. In general, the higher your score, the more education you'll get, the more money you'll make, and, believe it or not, the longer you'll live. But there's a catch. This relationship between success and IQ works only up to a point. Once someone has reached an IQ of somewhere around 120, having additional IQ points doesn't seem to translate into any measurable real-world advantage. It is amply proved that someone with an IQ of 170 is more likely to think well than someone whose IQ is 70, the British psychologist Liam Hudson has written. And this holds true where the comparison is much closer, between IQs of, say, 100 and 130. But the relation seems to break down when one is making comparisons between two people, both of whom have IQs which are relatively high. A mature scientist with an adult IQ of 130 is as likely to win a Nobel Prize as one whose IQ is 180. What Hudson is saying is that IQ is a lot like height in basketball. Does someone who is 5'6" have a realistic chance of playing professional basketball? Not really. You need to be at least 6 foot or 6'1" to think of playing at that level, and all things being equal, it's probably better to be 6'2" than 6'1" and better to be 6'3" than 6'2". But past a certain point, height stops mattering so much. A player who is 6'8" is not automatically better than someone 2 inches shorter. Michael Jordan, the greatest player ever, was 6'6" after all. A basketball player only has to be tall enough. And the same is true of intelligence. Intelligence has a threshold. The introduction to the 1 versus 100 episode pointed out that Einstein had an IQ of 150 and Langan has an IQ of 195. Langan's IQ is more than 30% higher than Einstein's. But that doesn't mean Langan is 30% smarter than Einstein. That's ridiculous. All we can say is that when it comes to thinking about really hard things like physics, they are both clearly smart enough. This idea that IQ has a threshold, I realize, goes against our intuition. We think that, say, Nobel Prize winners in science must have the highest IQ scores imaginable, that they must be the kinds of people who got perfect scores on their entrance examination in college and who won every scholarship available and had such stellar academic records in high school that they were scooped up by the top universities in the country. If you were to look at a list of where the last 25 Americans to win the Nobel Prize in Medicine got their undergraduate degree, you'd be surprised at what you'd find. Some of them went to Yale and Columbia and MIT, but some of them also went to DePauw, Holy Cross, and Gettysburg College. It's a list of good schools. Much the same thing holds true for the colleges of the Nobel Prize winners in chemistry. Harvard's on the list, but so are lots of schools that we don't think of as the best in the land. To be a Nobel Prize winner, apparently, you have to be smart enough to get into a college that's at least as good as Notre Dame or the University of Illinois. That's all. This is a radical idea, isn't it? Suppose that your teenage daughter found out that she'd been accepted at 2 universities, Harvard University and Georgetown University. Where would you want her to go? I'm guessing Harvard, because Harvard is a better school. Its students score a good 10 to 15% higher on their SATs, the dressed-up IQ test that virtually all American high school students have to take before applying to college. But given what we are learning about intelligence, the idea that students can be ranked, like runners in a race, makes no sense. Georgetown students may not be as smart on an absolute scale as the students of Harvard, but they are all clearly smart enough. And future Nobel Prize winners come from schools like Georgetown as well as from schools like Harvard. The psychologist Barry Schwartz recently proposed that elite schools give up on their complex admissions process and simply hold a lottery for everyone above the threshold. Put people into two categories, Schwartz says, good enough and not good enough. The ones who are good enough get put into a hat, and those who are not good enough get rejected. Schwartz concedes that his idea has virtually no chance of being accepted, but he's absolutely right. As Hudson writes, and keep in mind that he did his research at elite all-male English boarding schools in the 1950s and 1960s, knowledge of a boy's IQ is of little help if you are faced with a formful of clever boys. Let me give you another, perhaps more serious example of the threshold effect in action. The University of Michigan Law School, like many elite U.S. educational institutions, uses a policy of affirmative action when it comes to applicants from disadvantaged backgrounds. Around 10% of the students Michigan enrolls each fall are members of racial minorities, and if the school didn't significantly relax its entry requirement for those students, letting them in with lower undergraduate grades and standardized test scores than everyone else, it estimates that percentage would be less than 3%. Furthermore, if you compare the grades that the minority and non-minority students get in law school, the white students do better. That's not surprising. If one group has higher undergraduate grades and test scores than another, it's almost certainly going to have higher grades in law school as well. This is the reason why affirmative action programs are so controversial. In fact, an attack on the University of Michigan's affirmative action program recently went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems troubling for an elite educational institution to let in students who are less qualified than their peers. A few years ago, however, the University of Michigan decided to look closely at how the law school's minority students had fared after they graduated. How much money did they make? How far up in the profession did they go? How satisfied were they with their careers? What kind of social and community contributions did they make? What kind of honors had they won? They looked at everything that could conceivably be an indication of real-world success. And what they found surprised them. We knew that our minority students, a lot of them, were doing well, says Richard Lempert, one of the authors of the Michigan study. I think our expectation was that we would find a half or two-thirds full glass, that they had not done as well as the white students, but nonetheless a lot were quite successful. But we were completely surprised. We found out that they were doing every bit as well. There was no place where we saw any serious discrepancy. What Lempert is saying is that by the only measure that a law school really ought to care about, how well its graduates do in the real world, minority students aren't less qualified. They're just as successful as white students. And why? Because even though the academic credentials of minority students at Michigan aren't as good as those of white students, the quality of students at the law school is high enough that they're still above the threshold. They are smart enough. Knowledge of a law student's test scores is of little help if you are faced with a classroom of clever law students. Let's take the threshold idea one step further. If intelligence only matters up to a point, then past that point, other things, things that have nothing to do with intelligence, must start to matter more. It's like basketball again. Once you're tall enough, then we start to care about speed and court sense and shooting touch. So what might some of those other things be? Well, suppose that instead of measuring your IQ, I gave you a totally different kind of test. Write down as many different uses that you can think of for the following objects: a brick, a blanket. This is what's called a divergence test, as opposed to a test like the Ravens, which asks you to sort through a list of possibilities and converge on the right answer. It requires you to use your imagination and take your mind in as many different directions as possible. With a divergence test like this, there obviously isn't a single right answer. What the test giver is looking for is the number and the uniqueness of your responses. And what the test is measuring isn't analytical intelligence, but something profoundly different, something much closer to creativity. Divergence tests are every bit as challenging as convergence tests, and if you don't believe that, I encourage you to pause and try the brick and blanket test right now. Here, for example, are answers to the uses of objects test collected by Liam Hudson from a student named Poole at a top British high school. Brick, to use in smash and grab raids, to help hold a house together, to use in a game of Russian roulette if you want to keep fit at the same time. Bricks at 10 paces, turn and throw, no evasive action allowed. To hold the eiderdown on a bed, tie a brick at each corner, as a breaker of empty Coca-Cola bottles. Blanket, to use on a bed, as a cover for illicit sex in the woods, as a tent, to make smoke signals with, as a sail for a boat, cart, or sled, as a substitute for a towel, as a target for shooting practice for short-sighted people, as a thing to catch people jumping out of burning skyscrapers. It's not hard to read Poole's answers and get some sense of how his mind works. He's funny. He's a little subversive and libidinous. He has a flair for the dramatic. His mind leaps from violent imagery to sex to people jumping out of burning skyscrapers to very practical issues like how to get a duvet to stay on a bed. He gives the sense that if you gave him another 10 minutes, he'd come up with another 20 uses. Now, for the sake of comparison, consider the answers of another student from Hudson's sample. His name is Florence. Hudson tells us that Florence is a prodigy with one of the highest IQs in the school. Brick, building things, throwing. Blanket, keeping warm, smothering fire, tying to trees and sleeping in as a hammock, improvised stretcher. Where is Florence's imagination? He identified the most common and most functional uses for bricks and blankets and simply stopped. The fact that Florence's IQ is higher than Poole's tells us nothing, since both students are above the threshold. What matters is that Poole's mind can leap from violent imagery to sex to people jumping out of buildings without missing a beat, and Florence's mind can't. Now, which of those two students do you think is better suited to do the kind of brilliant, imaginative work that wins Nobel Prizes? That's the second reason Nobel Prize winners come from Holy Cross as well as Harvard, because Harvard isn't selecting its students on the basis of how well they do on the uses of a brick test. It's also the reason Michigan Law School couldn't find a difference between its affirmative action graduates and the rest of its alumni. Being a successful lawyer is about more than IQ. It involves having the kind of fertile mind that Poole had. And just because Michigan's minority students have lower scores on convergence tests doesn't mean they don't have that other critical trait in abundance. This was Terman's error. He fell in love with the fact that his termites were the absolute pinnacle of the intellectual scale, at the 99th percentile of the 99th percentile, without realizing how little that seemingly extraordinary fact meant. By the time the termites reached adulthood, Terman's error was plain. Some of his child geniuses had grown up to publish books and scholarly articles and thrive in business. Several ran for public office, and there were 2 Superior Court justices, 1 municipal court judge, 2 members of the California state legislature, and 1 prominent state official. But few were nationally known figures. They tended to earn good incomes, but not that good. The majority had careers that could only be considered ordinary, and a surprising number ended up with careers that even Terman considered failures. Nor were there any Nobel Prize winners in his exhaustively selected group of geniuses. His fieldworkers actually tested 2 future Nobel laureates as elementary students, William Shockley and Luis Alvarez, and rejected them both. Their IQs weren't high enough. In a devastating critique, the sociologist Pitcham Sorokin once showed that if Terman had simply put together a randomly selected group of children from the same kind of family backgrounds as the termites, and dispensed with IQs altogether, he would have ended up with a group doing almost as many impressive things as his painstakingly selected group of geniuses. By no stretch of the imagination or of standards of genius, Sorokin concluded, is the gifted group as a whole gifted. By the time Terman came out with his 4th volume of Genetic Studies of Genius, the word genius had all but vanished except for the title. We have seen, Terman concluded, with more than a touch of disappointment, that intellect and achievement are far from perfectly correlated. In other words, what I told you at the beginning of this chapter about the extraordinary intelligence of Chris Langan is of little use if we want to understand his chances of being a success in the world. Yes, he's a man with a one-in-a-million mind and the ability to get through Principia Mathematica at 16. Yes, his sentences come marching out one after another, polished and crisp like soldiers on a parade ground. But so what? If we want to understand his chances of succeeding in the world, we have to know a lot more about him than that. Chapter 4, The Trouble with Geniuses, Part 2. After protracted negotiations, it was agreed Robert would be put on probation. Chris Langan's mother was from San Francisco and was estranged from her family. She had four sons, each with a different father. Chris was the eldest. His father disappeared before Chris was born. He was said to have died in Mexico. His mother's second husband was murdered. Her third committed suicide. Her fourth was a failed journalist named Jack Langan. To this day, I haven't met anyone who was as poor when they were kids as our family was, Chris Langan says. We didn't have a pair of matched socks. Our shoes had holes in them. Our pants had holes in them. We only had one set of clothes. I remember my brothers and I going to the bathroom and using the bathtub to wash our only set of clothes, and we were bare-ass naked when we were doing that because we didn't have anything else to wear. Jack Langan would go on drinking sprees and disappear. He would lock the kitchen cabinets so the boys couldn't get to the food. He used a bullwhip to keep the boys in line. He would get jobs and then lose them, moving the family on to the next town. One summer, the family lived on an Indian reservation in a teepee, subsisting on government surplus peanut butter and cornmeal. For a time, they lived in Virginia City, Nevada. There was only one law officer in town, and when the Hell's Angels came to town, he would crouch down in the back of his office, Mark remembers. There was a bar there, I'll always remember. It was called the Bucket of Blood Saloon. When the boys were in grade school, the family moved to Bozeman, Montana. One of Chris's brothers spent time in a foster home. Another was sent to reform school. I don't think the school ever understood just how gifted Christopher was, his brother Jeff says. He sure as hell didn't play it up. This was Bozeman. It wasn't like it is today. It was a small hick town when we were growing up. We weren't treated well there. They just decided that my family was a bunch of deadbeats. To stick up for himself and his brothers, Chris started to lift weights. One day, when Chris was 14, Jack Langan got rough with the boys, as he sometimes did, and Chris knocked him out cold. Jack left, never to return. Upon graduation from high school, Chris was offered two full scholarships, one to Reed College in Oregon and the other to the University of Chicago. He chose Reed. It was a huge mistake, Chris recalls. I had a real case of culture shock. I was a crew-cut kid who had been working as a ranch hand in the summers in Montana. And there I was with a whole bunch of long-haired city kids, most of them from New York. And these kids had a whole different style than I was used to. I couldn't get a word in edgewise in class. They were very inquisitive, asking questions all the time. I was crammed into a dorm room. There were four of us, and the other three guys had a whole different lifestyle. They were smoking pot. They would bring their girlfriends into the room. I'd never smoked pot before, so I basically took to hiding in the library. He continued, "Then I lost that scholarship. My mother was supposed to fill out a parent's financial statement for the renewal of that scholarship. She neglected to do so. She was confused by the requirements or whatever. At some point, it came to my attention that my scholarship had not been renewed. So I went to the office to ask why, and they told me, well, no one sent us the financial statement, and we allocated all the scholarship money, and it's all gone, so I'm afraid that you don't have a scholarship here anymore." That was the style of the place. They simply didn't care. They didn't give a shit about their students. There was no counseling, no mentoring, nothing. Chris left Reed before the final set of exams. In the first semester, he had earned A's. In the second semester, he had F's. He went back to Bozeman and worked in construction and as a Forest Service's firefighter for a year and a half. Then he enrolled at Montana State University. "I was taking math and philosophy courses," he recalled. And then in the winter quarter, I was living 13 miles out of town, out on Beech Hill Road, and the transmission fell out of my car. My brothers had used it when I was gone that summer. They were working for the railroad and had driven it on the railway tracks. I didn't have the money to repair it, so I went to the dean and my advisor.